You do want me out by far. So I'll try and get through these questions. I didn't realise there were so many, actually. Been meditating for years. Now, for a few years, I get jerky movements while meditating. They do me no harm. If I tried to do it, I'd probably injure myself. And the movements can be quite severe. The movements seem to be come mainly from the lower torso area. When you sit in this posture, especially, you're awakening what, say, in Hinduism they call kundalini, or chi in the West. We don't seem to have that concept in the West at all. The only person that had some inkling of it was Reich with his organ. Did anybody know Reich and his organ?
Yes.
And his organ, what did he call a machine?
Yeah.
Measured it, he had a machine. I can't remember it. That seems to be the only... It's the same thing that, say, acupuncture works with. It's that sort of... In Buddhism, it's called life energy, jiva, life energy. And as soon as you sit, it starts moving up, you see. When it comes across some turbulence, I don't like the word blockage, but you know what I mean, something heavy, then the energy starts moving, you see. So often you get people swaying, all this sort of stuff. I'm shaking heads. To stop that, just sit up, and it'll slowly purify that, you see. So it might be some pretty heavy stuff that's been suppressed there, and you might get a lot of pain, a lot of burning, a lot of shaking, or feeling of shaking, right? But try not to move, and eventually it'll clear itself. And you may not know what caused it. You know, just something buried from the past. Yeah. Have other people had similar experiences like that? Yeah, you've had that. Nobody else, only me, is it? Ah, there you go, okay. Would you agree with me? That's what you do. Would you agree with me that's what you did? You sat up and it sort of...
That it went away after sitting up?
Well, it goes away in time. It works its way out of the system.
Yeah, no? It's gone in cycles.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah, there's some periods where there's a lot of involuntary movement.
That's it. Yeah. So I just... if you move with it, you see, you're not really helping it to clear the passage, that's all. During the meditations, I noticed that feelings arise. I try to do, as you say, and just observe them. However, fear arises and I find myself in a state of flux. What should I do when that happens? Well, when something arises and we're not... it's a bit unknown to us, or... for some reason, some fear arises because we're not sure of what's going to happen or whatever. Right? It's the fear you put your attention on. Right? So you're looking at something coming up and then you find yourself sort of pulling away from it. So your attention moves to that pulling away, to that fear. So you feel the fear. Yeah, feel it. So you're still aware of what's coming up, but you're aware also of this projection. Hmm? And just stay there. Right? Don't do anything. Just feel it. And eventually, you become equanimous. You become at ease with what's actually arising. And at that point, you go into what's actually arising, and it comes up. It'll exhaust itself. It'll manifest. Once the fear goes, if you see, you've opened the door for it. So it may come up even worse. When it comes up even worse, then you're really afraid, and the fear comes back up. See? So you observe the fear, and you go through the same process. Right? So the fear is just a fear of the unknown, isn't it? You don't know what's happening, you're not certain about it. But your attention always goes to your reaction, the fear, the aversion. Yeah? I'm expecting you all to nod vigorously. You're looking at me. If you have any questions about this, you know, just say so. Or criticisms. I love a good criticism. Yeah, is that all right? Those of you who know dependent origination, you're observing the distinction between Vedana, the feeling, and Tanha, which is arising. That's all. You're staying right there. Now, that is the escape from suffering. Right? Through that gap between what's arising and how you're relating to it. Are you saying that desire and indulgence are bad? And to notice when it arises, and that desire and good intentions is good. Desire translates just these two words in the Pali language. One is tanha, which is a desire arising out of wrong understanding. So in other words, greed, hatred, fear, etc. There's another word, chanda, which you can either say is a good desire or a bad desire. Right? You can say it's mitya chanda or whatever. Now, a good desire would be to practice metta bhavana. There's nothing wrong with that, you see. So don't get confused by this word desire. It's what you're desiring that you have to become aware of. And if you see it's unskillful, don't do it. Simple, isn't it? Just don't do it.
Can I question that then?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. Are you saying that sexual desire is unskillful then?
Oh, it's absolutely, it doesn't say that.
Oh, no.
It says desire. Well, sexual desire is natural, isn't it? Erotic feelings, I mean, you know. The thing is, are you going to develop them or not? And they should, I mean, ideally, they should be developed in a loving relationship, and then they have a deeper meaning. But, I mean, you drive yourself crazy. Yeah. I mean, the whole pornography industry relies on people indulging their erotic desires. But in itself, it's just a desire. There's nothing wrong in it. It's your relationship to it which is causing the problems. Yeah? And the same with romance, romantic feelings. See, they arise naturally. They're very specific, aren't they? Yeah?
Yeah.
Who or what really gets the karma? Right, okay. here the word karma is being used as consequence, right? So you do something and somebody gets it. Somebody has to deal with the problem. Okay. In terms of just forgetting there's a person or anything, if somebody makes an intention and does something, there's always a consequence. Okay? So even if you invite a friend and say, you know, come over for a meal, there's a consequence. You're going to have to cook the meal, right? You can't. So this self who said, right, in a happy tone, come over and have a meal, okay? Then another self arises which remembers that the meal's got to be cooked and doesn't feel like doing it. So every self that arises is a relationship with what you're actually experiencing at that moment. So at some point you remember, oh, I've got Jack coming over and I'll have to cook him a meal. So it's not the same person, it's not the same self that's receiving the consequence, it's just another self. Right, it's passing on. But the thing is that you're always experiencing the self. Huh? It's not as though this self that I had yesterday is something that I didn't experience. Right? Yesterday I was this self, right? And I was happy to invite Jack. Today I'm this self and I don't want him to come. See what I mean? It's like this self is now suffering the consequence of that self who was happy to do that. Right? So now the question is, right, who or what is actually suffering? That's the question. Apart from Jack.
It's a new self, isn't it?
No. What is it that in us that's suffering? Okay, so we've just been meditating. We've felt some feelings inside us. Let's say some painful thing, pain in the knee. So there's a pain in the knee, and then suddenly there's somebody who feels the pain in the knee. I pull out of that, and I become the observer of the pain in the knee. Right? So the pain in the knee is no longer me. I'm the observer. I'm the one who knows the pain. Okay? Pain gets really sort of a bit tough, so I find myself getting agitated with it, find myself getting fearful about it. Right? And I pull out of the fear, and I notice that there is fear, but I'm not the fear. I'm the one who knows the fear, feels the fear. Right? Yeah? Now, suddenly it gets too much, and I become the fear. Who's become the fear? What's become the fear?
Identification.
Yeah, but what's identified with it?
Attachment.
Eh? No, awareness. Awareness. It's the Buddha. The Buddha suffers. The Buddha in you is suffering. That's why he's trying to find an escape. The body doesn't suffer. The body just has pain. Eh? The heart doesn't suffer. It just has this feeling that we call emotions. The mind just thinks. There's no thinker there. But something happens whereby this Buddha within suddenly jumps in and says, "This is me." And then he suffers.
But is there an interval between the one and the other?
Only in that sense that if the Buddha within actually pulls itself out and observes it as an object, it's not suffering. Doesn't mean to say it's not a pleasant. It becomes a pleasant place. If you're you've got a lot of worry or something, and you observe the worry, it doesn't mean to say the worry is not a pleasant place to be. It's an unpleasant place to be.
So does that mean that if you don't identify with the consequences of your unskillful actions, then you don't have to worry about them?
Well, it's not so much you don't have to worry about them. You don't suffer from them.
But somebody else will.
No. If you're a Buddha, that self doesn't arise.
So
that's
the
point.
Your attachment to it is delusional.
That's right. The delusion of self is creating the attachment. Because you're saying, well, you know, this anger is me. Or this grief is me. I'm sad. You know, I'm the one that... Me. So as soon as you say, I'm sad, well, you are sad.
I'm thinking of what one of my tutors once said, that there is only one energy. What the mind does with this energy is another story. Is that the same thing, what you were saying?
You might be talking about...
So in other words, if you really are able to disidentify, observe the pain or whatever it is, to such a degree that you're no suffering, does it mean that the pain isn't actually there, or is it still there? But it's just energy, but not experienced as suffering, because actually it isn't. It was the...
Yeah, that's right, right. But and as you say, it's still there, but it's not experienced as, I am suffering pain.
Right, so there isn't a dodgy me, in other words.
There is a dodgy knee, and you ought to get it seen to. But,
but that's really important.
That's the point. Yeah. The point is, there is a dodgy knee, but my worry about it is unnecessary. But it's not me.
Right, because to me that still entails a split. That there is a...
There is.
Buddha nature.
That's right.
And a dodgy knee.
That's it.
And that has quite made sense to me.
Oh.
Yeah, but that's just something I'm having to work out.
Well, in your meditation, you're constantly looking at something. Right, so the perceiver can't be the perceived. Yes.
So, what's the difference between observing and thinking?
Well, in this sense, when you're thinking, you're using thought patterns.
But are you kind of doing that when you're observing?
Not if you're observing without thought. So, for instance, next time you're in a garden or something. Just sweep across it like a camera, pan across the garden, right? And don't think about anything. Just watch how the eye picks things up, right? And the eye is picking things up, and then you'll see the mind stick a label on it. Yeah, it'll go, you know, bing, rose, bing, daffodil, bing, right? And you're not thinking, you're just watching that process. So you're observing thought. If you're aware of something, you must be observing it.
So could we say that suffering comes from being one-pointed or absorbed in the wrong things, basically? So if I have a pain in the knee, I will absorb myself in the pain instead of being absorbed in my breathing or in something else. You say it's a wrong one-pointedness or something that creates
the suffering, as you say, like the one pointedness makes us absorbed in some things that's creating the suffering.
Well, not necessarily, because if you go into pain as an observer, as the observer, you can become so interested in what's happening that the sense of the self disappears. There's just the observing, just the feeling. Okay. So in Buddhism, there's two consciousnesses happening. There's one that's actually looking at the knee, and there's one that's looking at the looking at the knee. Right? And it disappears. This comes, this goes, like that. It's going at tremendous speed, so it feels it all happening at the same time.
Can you explain what disappears again, sorry?
It's the feeling of a self. The self is self-awareness, isn't it? Mm-hmm. There's something aware of itself. Mm-hmm. What's it aware of? It's aware of an image, isn't it? Or a feeling, a sense of presence. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Can you feel yourself now? Mm-hmm. See, I'm here, you see? So what is that? You can't be that, can you? Because you're aware of it. It's a killer, isn't it? It becomes a paradox, and of course in Zen they have this beautiful, like, for instance, the sound of one hand clapping. See, it's like it's cutting through the paradox. What is your original face? That's the one I like. What is your original face?
Can I pursue original line? What was behind my question was that I once heard the CEO of Dixon's, which doesn't exist anymore, interviewed, and he said, referring to all the very unskillful actions that he had perpetrated, I'm not responsible for the consequences of my actions.
Is that what he said?
Yeah. And I was shocked.
Yeah, no, he should have been taken out and hanged.
So, can I interject? It's a bit topical, but Mr. Blair is trying to punch his hanger in the same way. It's all a mess, but, you know, what could he do?
You know, isn't it a cop-out? I mean, can you not cop-out by saying...
Well, that's up to the Lord.
The self, you know, by separating yourself from your actions.
Well, the point is that they come back at you. Remember that when you do something, the action goes into a matrix. So, you might do a simple act of generosity to somebody. And, you know, the chaos theory in physics, you know, you do a simple action with supporting conditions, you know, a little blast of wind becomes a hurricane, all that sort of stuff, right? So, it's the same in terms of our actions. You know, by doing something kind to somebody, you might change their lives, and that changes other people's lives, and it reverberates. But it's also true within us. You don't know what an action is going to do inside you, because it moves into a matrix of your own psychology. So it might be that suddenly you turn around and you see somebody, as you would say, in a desperate state, and you're moved to help them, and you help them. Before you know it, you've set up a charity. Yeah?
So, yeah, it's just this whole thing of, it seems so central, the whole idea of observation of experience and who's observing and how we're doing it. I was just wondering, because there's a little phrase from, I think, the Kalaka Sutta, where the Buddha says, I think it's Tarkasa, when seeing what is to be seen, does not construe an object to seen, does not construe an unseen, does not construe an object to be seen, and does not construe...
Yeah. Say that again, the first part.
So when seeing what is to be seen,
yes,
does not construe an object as seen, does not construe an unseen,
yeah,
does not construe an object to be seen,
yeah,
and does not construe the seer.
That's right.
So it seems there's not a sense of self, there's not a sense of object, there's not...
No. He's saying when you see things clearly as they are, uh-huh, that construction doesn't happen. So going back to the idea of this little girl who was watching a beetle, as soon as she was given a word for it and she created an image in her mind, a perception of it, and the perception grew to a concept of what beetles are, every time she sees a beetle, she construes beetle. She doesn't see the beetle, that particular beetle, completely individuated. To do that, she has to go back down to looking at the beetle.
And is that the same with the pain in the knee?
Yeah, that's right.
So
the pain
in the knee isn't there, except you bring it into the present.
No. The concept of pain isn't there. The concept of pain isn't there.
But the, so, so
but the feeling is there.
Right, but there isn't an actual, this is what I'm wondering,
yeah,
actual pain in the knee, except the experience from the past is brought into the present.
That's right.
Like
as long as
you go
well,
to healing.
You know. Yeah, it's just a confusion of language.
Right.
The concept of pain isn't there ever.
Right.
What's there is, the concept of pain is in the mind.
Gotcha, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I thought, yeah.
It's just a way of, yeah.
So it's also the concept of I then, it's observing pain, it's also in the mind.
Yeah, the concept of I is that collapse into an identity with what you're experiencing. It's a relationship. It's, you know, some writers talk about selfing. It's an action.
Which actually means that once we're a memory of mine, you've been told with a starfish. Is it starfish?
Yeah.
Or Baudelaire? Is that starfish?
Right. Yeah.
I had a sense I lost something when somebody named it.
Ah, there we are.
And but it's something we have to live with. We have to name things.
That's fine. Well,
and once something is named, I mean, talking about a little girl, I'm sure the moment the little girl said, this is a beetle, so the next beetle becomes just...
another beetle.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, so to get back to that original way of looking at things, you have to put your attention directly on the sense base. What is it you are seeing? What is it you are smelling? What is it you are tasting?
So, I mean, in the chain of dependent origination, there is this concept of, like, name and form. So
yeah.
Is the name this kind of, like, habitual way of, like, putting things into categories? Or?
That's right, yeah. It's actually wider than that. It's the whole process of mentation from the perception stage right up to heavy sort of logical diatribes and all that sort of stuff. That's all nama, that's all mind. Rupa, body, is what you feel in the body, what's coming at you from the body. So an emotion is both a mental state, but it also has a physical representation. Yeah, so, you know, depression feels heavy, for instance, but it also comes with a mental state. Yeah,
okay.
Two things. They always come together. Although they're separate systems, they always come together.
So you mean, like, for instance, an emotion?
Yeah, you can't have an emotion without a feeling in the body.
Or if you have constant thoughts of depression, of constant thoughts of happiness, you're going to develop this. Like, if you think of happy things all the time, it's going to trigger a feeling, right? The contact. So it's mental contact, right?
That's it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
In Buddhism, the mind and the body are two different things. I mean, it doesn't work well with neurobiology, but they are.
I mean, Ajahn Mahabhua says that the citta and the pain and the body were three different things, right? When he talks about pain.
Two different things, no? He says three.
Three, like the body, the pain, and the citta.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. He's using citta there to mean what we would usually, what we would call a while back, the soul. So remember in medieval understanding, there was the body, the soul, and spirit. So the soul, the soul combined both thinking and feeling, emotions, which we separated at the Enlightenment of the 18th century. So Descartes sort of cut that, helped us to cut that. So now we've got rationality in the mind, and we don't have a word for emotion, so you use the word heart or something. So we've lost that combination, really. But often in the East, you'll find people, when they say, I think, they touch their heart. They don't say, you know, they're not pointing up here.
So aren't these all like word associations? I mean, like, to say, like, if you're looking at the self or the not self, isn't it just as, you know, or like emotions associated with feelings? But isn't that just word association, like the little girl with the beetle? The picture is the beetle,
yeah.
But the word is, the mind associates beetle with the word because she's been told, but it's a.
No, that's right. Well, that's what words are. I mean, that's why every language has a different word for beetle. The word itself is a sound, isn't it? I mean, if you say banana often enough, it becomes ridiculous.
Yeah. But, I mean, I suppose when it comes to looking at the self, I mean, because I'm looking at, say, like, from the point of view of the English language, whatever associations I have from what I've been taught.
That's true.
In order to communicate and associate. So,
yeah, yeah.
So obviously someone from the East would have a different association because they've been taught a different way.
Mm, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Because Buddhism has found it easy to move in and out of different cultures, I presume there would be a general agreement amongst all these cultures that there is this sense of self, however they name it. Yeah? Are we all in agreement? we've got that. Does the Buddha encourage us to reflect on rebirth and practice part of our teaching? Well, you know, rebirth's a bit difficult for Westerners. You know, we find it a bit heavy, rebirth. It's completely up to you whether you want to believe it or not. Even in the Buddha's time, there was, of course, scepticism about it. And his answer to that was, well, if you practice the Dharma, you'll get the benefit of it in this very life. If there is a future birth, then you'll get the benefit there as well. So it's like, you know, he's not going to argue about it. And I think the truth of that is, if you are heading towards liberation in this life, and there is rebirth, you'll keep doing that. Because that's your habit. Because all that's reborn are your habits. Your inclinations, your aspirations are reborn. How do we know that? Because it happens from day to day, doesn't it? Every time you wake up, you find yourself, you know, desiring, wishing, the same sort of thing. So you're guiding yourself one way or the other, professionally, relationship-wise. So rebirth is just that continuation, really.
So that means that the default mode of functioning doesn't have to be negative. It doesn't have to have the kilesas winning all the time, by default. Like if we're cultivating lots of good qualities, the Brahma Vihara and everything, then the whole habitual thing is going to be positive rather than negative.
That's it.
So the default mode is not necessarily to go towards enlightenment. You can already awake and you can wake up and you're already enlightened.
Ah, yes, well, there's that too.
Like the more habitual positive thing you have, and the less, like, the kilesas will win, right?
Yeah, no, that's it. Mm. Yeah. I mean, remember that nirvana or that state is not manufactured. It's not somewhere over there that you're going towards. You know, you don't get on a train in Manchester and presume London's being manufactured on the way there. It's already here, right? It's that which is fully liberated is already here, but he doesn't know it. That's all. You're not going to find anything new. You're looking at me with it. Stop looking at me. Yeah. Is that all right?
So all you need is some kind of direction, basically. You don't have
to look
at it directly, but not having a direction. So if you go on the train to Manchester, you look at the train to Manchester. You don't look at like the horizon to see where Manchester is. Right?
That's right.
So you always need to be right where you are if you know where you're going from where you are.
That's the path. That's what we mean by the path.
I see.
Yeah. Eightfold path. In metta, or when we're setting up intention, how do you practice how do you practice without, is it, sounding phony? When you have a concept of all living beings, would you have some tips to balance devotion with keeping a critical mind? Once I did metta, and somebody said to me, I can't offer the end of suffering to all beings. I said, why not? Because it's not going to happen. I said, that's logic. I said, you know, you're not, the heart doesn't speak in logic. It speaks in good wishes. It speaks in open intention, doesn't it? You know, they can be malevolent. You know, so you get yourself confused if you're going to be logical about developing metta. Metta is just an attempt to form a right relationship with the world. That's all. And that right relationship, at its base, the Buddha called metta, which is friendliness, goodwill. And out of that, everything else arises, really. We don't have to worry about the rest of it. Yeah?
Sorry, one question on that. Earlier you said that equanimity can lead, in vipassana, equanimity can lead to indifference.
Yeah.
You could say a little bit more about that?
When you're being equanimous in the meditation, it's actually supporting your inquiry, your interest in what's actually happening in you, you know, your investigation into yourself. In ordinary daily life, you can be in that state, but without the added interest or anything, and so you're always pulling yourself away. You think the not self position is not to be involved. I'll give you an example of that. Well, it's a sort of example. I once visited a monk, and there was a cat, and playing with a mouse. I mean, the mouse was dead. And I said to him, did you let him kill that mouse? He says, yeah. He said, it's cat karma, mouse karma. He's a big fat, sort of monastery cat. I said, yeah, right. Anyway, it just so happened on the very same day, I'm sitting with a few monks on a bench and we're chatting about something. And this cat comes out and jumps on a bird. Well, this monk, he jumped up like a flash of lightning, gave that cat one hell of a kick. Yeah? Got hold of the bird, realized it was dead, and beautifully held it up by its wings and chanted, all conditioned things arise and pass away. And then we buried it. See? So one is driven by this clear observer, cat karma, and the other one is a very compassionate sort of connection with what's happening. Yeah. Well, the cat didn't die. just went away rubbing his tummy.
Bante, sorry, can I just?
Yeah.
If in vipassana you're trying to remove yourself from self-identification, does that not in itself lead to an opening up of the heart to other beings, to everybody, really? Because if you're not yourself, you're not sort of caught up with yourself, then that allows you to.
Definitely, yeah. I think the self. Okay, let's go back to the original problem is that we are seeking happiness in this form. And that's the original problem, right? So we're born and we wake up and we want milk and we want this and we want that, and it carries on and on. And we're constantly seeking happiness in the form of a human being. Well, the problem is it can't deliver. If only on the point that everything arises and passes away anyway. As soon as you've got something, it disappears or it changes, right? So you've got this delusive way. We've got this delusive way of approaching the world, of acquiring things, because, you know, we feel happy when we've got lots of things. And then you have to defend it. There's your aversion. And when it's too much, you run for it. So there's your basic relationship. Now, when you've nothing to lose, the heart isn't blocked by its own desires, is it? So it becomes completely open. The barriers are taken down. You know, I mean, if I were to come in here, for instance, and teach, and I'm thinking, I've got a whole day, damn it, I'm going to get this over with. I'll just rip them through the old meditation, and I'll sit for a while, get through these questions, and get out and have a beer. No. Then, of course, I'm not going to be in contact with you, am I? Because my mind's going to be thinking, come on, get on with it, you know, what's the next question? But if I come in here with the attitude of, you know, like, what do they want from me, and I'm losing that self-centeredness, then, you know, I'm completely open to what you want. Now, the fact of the matter is, when I come in and I'm only regarding myself and what I need from this situation, then, of course, it becomes very self-centered, very tight, and my joy is going to be dependent on me and what I can generate in myself. Because everybody else is going to be really cheesed off with me. But what? On the other hand, now that if I come in with an open heart and ask you, you know, like, what do you want from me? You see, then there's that communication, and a lot of my joy is dependent upon you. Yeah, my joy in me is being created by me because of the feeling of joy that I'm getting from you. See, you're not creating the joy in me. I'm responding in me to the joy that you are offering me. You see what I mean? No? Yes, I'll try again.
referring to you've got nothing to do, there's this brilliant story that's been circulated within ambulances, like, about these guys on death row, I'm sure you've heard of it, who the wardens have been a bit concerned because these are hardline criminals, they're waiting to be executed, you know?
Yeah.
They wanted to know why they're being nice to each other. They sent some psychologists there to ask them, you know. And they said, it's very simple. They said, we know we're going to die. So what's the point of being fighting with each other? You know? Because they got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
So, I'm sort of following that thing about, you know, when you're expecting something, you know, obviously, you know, there's an agenda going. But if really, these guys are obviously somewhere where they've been given a date where they're going to be executed. And the wardens were a bit concerned, you know. These guys have been killing people, raping women and all sorts of things. Why are they being nice to each other? So they asked them and they said, well, you know, the difference between us and you is that we know we're going to die, that's for sure. So what have we got to lose?
Is there any difference for you?
Man?
You know you're going to die, don't you?
Yeah, I know I'm going to die.
So,
yeah, but I don't believe it.
So, I mean, how to deal with this tightness where we feel we're close to the world, like we feel like everything is an aggression and things like that. We just like shut ourselves and rest. Or,
well,
any like tips in terms of insight or vipassana? Because sometimes we're very tight.
Well, it might be that the world is being aggressive. I mean, you know, your work situation and all that sort of stuff. In which case, of course, you have to make sure that you don't react to it inwardly. See, so remember, when somebody's angry with you, all you're receiving is the sharp voice, the tortured face, and the feeling of their anger. But that's where it stops. The hurt you feel is generated by you. Yeah? And your response of anger or revenge is generated by you. They can't cause you to feel hurt. See? So once you've clicked onto that nobody can cause you suffering, that's your liberation. So now you can take control of your inner life. It doesn't mean to say you won't feel hurt, because that's an old habit. But now you won't be blaming anybody else for it.
Because it's quite advanced to reach that level, right?
It's really called sort of catching that, you know. I mean, it's a bit disappointing to recognise that, because you do like to get your own back. but that's it's like the old Chinese proverb, isn't it? What is it? If you seek revenge, prepare two graves.
I just wondered what your thoughts, how you might amplify the business of the arrow. This guy, you know, gets an arrow, and you could kind of pontificate about who made the arrow and where the poison came from.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, whatever, blah, all that. Or just get the effing arrow out
that's
now.
That's right. He also talks about two darts or two arrows. The first dart is the anger coming to you, right? But the second dart is the one you give to yourself by your reaction. And that's where the suffering starts. The other bit is just unpleasant.
So, I guess, like, if you're very advanced, like, instead of feeling like the honey tip of anger as like something pleasant or getting your revenge, you will see it as a hot coal, as the Buddha said, right? A hot coal that you pick and you throw, and you will feel the pain, and you will have aversion towards anger instead of having like pleasure towards anger, right?
Yeah.
It's some kind of like unworldly feeling or something.
Well, that's, you see, when you express your anger, when you bang a door or shout to somebody, it feels like a release, because it is a release. You're throwing the anger out of you.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in meditation, you feel the anger, you know it's not a pleasant state, huh?
Burn.
See, I was brought up a Catholic, so I have no problem with that. In Catholicism, you have three states. You have hell, purgatory, and heaven. Now, hell, of course, is just, that's it, you're done. Yeah, you're finished. And we are in hell states when we enter into those mental states where we don't see an end. You know, mental illness, where you just don't see an end to your depression, etc. That's a hell state. Purgatory is where you see your mental state and you can see an end to it. Right? And with the end of that state, you enter into a heavenly state. So psychologically, there is definitely hell, purgatory, and heaven. So when you have these states within you, you have to sit in the midst of the flames. You have to burn. You have to let it burn, you see. Now, what we have to discover is that if we're in that in the right way of just receiving, there's no suffering. It's unpleasant, but there's no suffering. And one thing that you can, one thing that can help you, and I haven't mentioned it, and I ought to have done, is affectionate awareness. By which I mean, when something painful comes up, you sort of approach it in kindness, as you would a little child who's upset. You see, but then you have to allow the heart to manifest its pain, and that's all. It's extremely simple, but it's difficult. It's difficult to do. But the more you do it, the more you get used to it, the more you get used to just sitting in these mental states. And over a period of time, you do actually see they're actually dying out. You know, you're not, like, you're not so ferocious. And it doesn't last so long. Sort of dying out, you know. It's like a process of purification.
Hmm. We tend to focus a lot on pain and suffering, but yeah. What about love, romantic love? The self and...
Oh, well, romantic love is a special thing, isn't it? You can't fall in love with anybody and everybody, right? That's a very specific relationship that you have with somebody to create a very intimate relationship, right? So that's... And I mean, at some point, that romantic love, it should be there as a little juicy bit that arises now and again. But the actual connection between human being and human being should become deeper and deeper with that close connection, shouldn't it? Right? So there's a distinction there. So you still love somebody even when they're not doing what you want them to do or they're being horrible or something. You know what I mean? Love isn't an emotion. Romance is, but love isn't. Love is an attitude. It's a way of relating to somebody.
Yeah, I'm talking about the very first, very intense stages of falling in love, I suppose.
Yeah, it only happens once.
Speak for yourself.
The next one's never. The next one's never. That's sort of a different category, if you know what I mean. And it's very specific.
It's chemical.
And it's very...
Huh? It's a chemical.
It's a chemical.
A disease.
It's not a disease, no.
I don't seem to hear much about how the Buddha coped with his wife when she came back, when she joined the fold. Is there anything about this?
No.
Did she say, where were you when my boy was growing up? Did she?
I think in those days they had a sort of extended family. She was probably happy to get rid of him, I think. he was sort of depressive and moaning about life and rebirth. And he thought, go on!
All I've heard so far is that the boy cried his eyes out and said, I've come for my inheritance.
Well, no, he didn't cry his eyes out.
It should have been the other way around.
No, he didn't cry his eyes out. Well, not as well in the scriptures. The mother just said, that's your father, go and ask for your inheritance, meaning that he should pass on his, right? But the Buddha took him into the order. And that upset his mother and father and said, look, you know, we had you as our heir, and now you've got rid of the other heir. They were very upset. So he made a rule, actually. He made a rule that anybody joining the order must have the permission of their parents, no matter how old the parents are. So it really, it sort of struck him that, you know, that wasn't a particularly...
But I don't get a picture of the wife.
Well, she joins the order in later life, and, you know, as the stories go, she became fully liberated.
She became liberated, yeah.
The whole court moved. You know, there's a story about them proving to the Buddha that they could live this very basic life. So they dressed in the rag robes, they turned up and all that. And he refused to do it. And it's always taken that he was, that was a sexist move, you know. But he's probably being realistic with court ladies. Eventually, of course, he gave in when Ananda said, you know, can women become fully liberated? Yeah, he said, well, shouldn't they have the same? They did wrong. But there's also evidence in the scriptures that there were women before that who joined, and he gave them the same ordination. Ehi Pasiko, come and try. Mm. But we're stuck with this courtly ladies turning up and wanting, you know, and this rejection of them. But he'd actually, seemingly, accepted women before that.
Yeah.
Move on. Yes. Oh heavens! What is the nature of the kilesa? They are defilements. Why are they so demanding? What is their use in terms of survival instinct? I understand why we feel pleasure and pain, but what's the use of sadistic tendencies? And loving and something gossip and liking about one's achievement, like bragging about one's achievement. Is the path consisting in fighting with them in the sense of not giving in? Are they strong because we've been feeding them through the patterns and repetitions of countless lives? Yes. That's it. Yeah. All that is true. You have to don't so much fight them as more as not giving in to them, yeah. If you fight them, then you create that relationship of aversion, so you're just messing things up even worse. But I think one thing we begin to recognise when we do begin to practice how strong these habits are. They're very strong. So it's a case of chipping at it and not being overly concerned if you fall into an old habit. You know, you just pick yourself up, dust yourself off, start all over again. Remember Fred Astaire, don't you? He's an arahant. Yeah. You mentioned that the Buddha didn't teach that there was a soul and that he pointed to it. Could you say more? No. In those days, there was seemingly a confusion as to what the self was. And the characteristics of a self is, A, that it is absolutely permanent. It does not change. If it changes, then it obviously can't be the same soul. Can't be the same self or soul, right? We'll use the word soul. If the soul changes, then it can't be permanent. Permanency means it doesn't change. Secondly, it must have power over itself. You know, if I say this is me, I have to have complete power over me, or else it's not me, because the centre of power is somewhere else. So that's what I find about the body, isn't it? So that's in the discourse on how to investigate this. He says, if the body were me, I could say, you know, be a bit taller, have a bit more hair, and and that would, you know, I'd have been. You know, but I can't. I've ended up with this. It's not my body. So control is key to the idea of self, of me. So there were those two things, impermanence. So, and if I am in total control, I should be able to say, I will be happy now. I am happy now and be happy now. See what I mean? So he asks us to investigate all our experience to see if anything is not permanent, is completely happy, and is in control of itself. Right? And those are your three characteristics. Impermanence, desire, the role of desire, suffering, what's the other word they use? Unsatisfactoriness, and not self. Right? So that's the Holy Grail. We're trying to find something in us which doesn't change, it doesn't suffer, and it's in complete control of itself. Good luck. could you please walk us through dependent origination with a very down-to-earth example? Yeah. There's a fundamental underlying ignorance of seeking happiness in this life. Okay? And what really makes you happy is ice cream. Okay, so the first thing is you see ice cream. That's the contact, and with it there comes a certain feeling arising. Right. The second point is to say that is really pleasant. That is really a nice thing to have. Right. So that's your next step. So the first thing is it's not a world that's separated into pleasant and unpleasant, but we immediately do so. Right. As soon as I've said that, I have a reaction to that of wanting. So, want the ice cream, right? Then I identify with that desire, I, and then I go and get it. So, psychologically, ice cream, see, like, want, I, get. Got it? Yeah? If the I came before, there'd be no escape. That was the crucial insight of the Buddha, of which there was nothing like it at his time. That the I was manufactured at the end of the process. If it was manufactured at the beginning of the process, there couldn't be no escape from suffering. It's because we can stop the process moving into identity that we can see the way out. Fabulous. Should have got the Nobel Prize. Would you have any tips for going from first to second jhana, how to make sure we focus on the sukha? And lay people fall. Yeah, if you're practicing in the ayakama, when you enter into a sort of absorption, you'll see that it can be very physical, a very physical delight in the body. And there's also in that, of course, the mental delight, you see? So you keep doing the practice, but you keep averting your attention to the mental delight. And eventually the body falls away and the mental delight comes forward. And then in the mental delight, you'll see that there's an underlying ground of equanimity. So your attention moves to the equanimity and eventually... So it's a refinement of the mind from, happiness in the body to happiness to peacefulness. Just a refinement. See, where it's always where you put your attention. Yeah.
Is that somewhat different to when you're listening to beautiful music and you lose yourself? Is that the same sort of absorption?
Yes. I mean, it can be very similar, especially if it's music which is raising joy in you or something. But of course, it's dependent on music. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. Whereas this is not dependent on anything outside you. Right. It's self-generated.
But if you happy about a station, you should enjoy yourself, or you should like...
You say that again?
If you happy about a station, you like start thinking about it, thinking, like, you know, feeling happy, like, be emotional. Should you just, like, you know, stand back and observe it rather than, like, you know, be engaged?
No, happiness... When happiness comes, whatever it be, a physical pleasure, you know, like eating or something, or meeting a friend or something like that, we should enjoy it. But we should also remind ourselves that it comes to an end. And that puts a certain level of reality on it. That's all.
Because, like, sometimes what I feel like, you're happy about something and everything goes well, and the world is like, I don't know, like, you know, it's stretching, you're happy, and the more happy, the more, like, station contrasts. And
then it collapses, you mean?
And it collapses, yeah.
That's right. So now you know.
Yeah.
Happiness doesn't last. So as long as you're aware of that, you enjoy the ride and then let it go.
How long can you enjoy the ride?
For as long as it's coming to you. See, now that's a good point. If you're grasping it, you're going to create more suffering for yourself. It's like enjoying it as it comes. A lovely that lovely little phrase from Blake. To kiss a joy as it rises. To kiss a joy as it flies. Is to live in eternity's sunrise. Right? To kiss a joy as it flies is to live in eternity's sunrise. So if you try and catch it, that's it, you see.
Yes, he bends to himself for joy, does the wing of life destroy.
That's it.
That's the first part.
That's right, he who bends
to himself for joy, does the wing of life destroy.
Perfect, you see. Fully liberated, Blake. Is stream entry achievable? Yes. What are the main misconceptions about stream entry? What is the main misconception about what stream entry is? I don't know. It can be, I suppose it can be misconstrued in all sorts of ways. Normally speaking, when you have a person who has stream entry, normally their life changes. That would be the telltale, because you've recentered yourself. You're in a different perspective of life. Yeah. Is it triggered by insight, weighted by concentration? Upasika Key says that it is like leaving a foreign language and becoming fluent in the language of Dharma. Would you agree with that? Well, in the sense that. If you actually have an experience where you know what you really are, this original face, this right, then of course it changes your relationship to everything, doesn't it? Before you thought you were a human being. What a mistake. See, before you thought you were a human being, heavens. And now you realise you're not. You're just in it, not of it. Difficult that one, isn't it? So that would change your relationship, wouldn't it? Supposing you were you suddenly realised you were actually an alien in a human body, and that you shouldn't be here. It's only been a mistake. Right? So if you were a Zen master, you'd burst out laughing. We've done this. If there's no self, what is reincarnated? No, we haven't done that. Reincarnated. Remember, what's moving, shall we say, is the Buddha within. And it's finding itself in a different life form. And as soon as it does that, it keeps making the mistake of thinking, this is me. If you can imagine that. And the thing is that we're doing it quite obviously every morning. That's the point. Every time you wake up, that's what you're doing. You're rebirthing.
So that's the same as continually seeking something to identify with.
Yeah, that's it, you see. There's no specific difference between waking up in the morning and dying and waking up. What happens to our realization once we die and this body and memory are erased? Why you've reached some past moment, like once returner, how could you know in your next life that you have reached this realization? What about this present life? It's a funny thing, but from sort of experience that I've personally had with meditators, if you take most human beings, the vast majority, they rise quite naturally to the age of 7, mentally. By which I mean that at the age of 7, two things happen to us. We first of all begin to realise that there is consequences to bad actions, right? You can have shame, it seems, at the age of 2 or 3, but you can't have guilt. Guilt arises around about 7. And really that's the story of the Bible, you know. And the other thing that happens is, of course, things are more reality tested. So you can't, Father Christmas simply cannot come down the chimney anymore. Somebody heard an argument actually between 6 and 8 year olds, you know, over that. Roaring argument, it seems. Yes, he can. Don't be deaf. Should have heard it, it's fantastic. that happens to us naturally as soon, for most, you know, for the vast majority, as a human being. And it would seem that depending on what you achieved in your past life, you rise to it naturally. So sometimes when somebody enters the stream, the stream entrant, it's like nothing. Like nothing's really happened. They don't feel any big change, nothing's happened. And for others, it's like an explosion. Turns their life upside down. And what I would suggest is that for the first type, they're just arriving at where they were and then continuing the journey. And for the others, it's actually a breakthrough. But I've never seen that explained anywhere. You know, I've never read about it, or it's not, it's definitely not in the scriptures that I know of. Anyway. All the commentaries I've read, I've not read all the commentaries; they're massive. But the main one, you know, the Visuddhimagga. But that's the sense I get.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
But this experience of stream entry, where you say you see like your original face or something, you need to repeat it many, many times. You need to make it a habitual thing, right, to reach the next stage. I don't know.
No, to reach the next stage, you have to put that behind you, and then the process begins again. Exactly the same, but at a deeper level. And with it, there comes a deeper purification. So remember that things like restlessness, conceit, they stay with you to the bitter end. you don't get off easy.
So there is always a danger of being too proud, or like the guru attitude kind of. It's always there, right? You always need to be checked by your sangha around you or something to prevent this kind of conceit from being too big or something.
Yeah, no, you can be mistaken. You can overestimate where you are. Mm. We had a monk who did that. I forgot time. It was 5 past 5. Forgot time. We had a monk who did that. He left a book on how he'd achieved nibbana, how he'd achieved liberation, right? And he said he's going to die on Christmas Day. Of all days, Christmas Day. So on Christmas, I used to go and visit an old friend, and because he used to fry eggs for me. And I was there at Christmas, and I came back, and I said to the abbot, "Is he dead?" He said, "No, he didn't die." And he'd been taking a sleeping pill before, so everybody thought, "God, he's going to commit suicide." An elderly man. And this went on for a while. And then what happens is, when somebody does that, what the order does is it meets, and it declares the person insane. Very simple, right? So he's not anything harm, he's just insane. So anyway, he got his son finally came, took him home, and a few weeks later or something, he wrote a letter saying that he had actually been fooled by Mara, right, the evil one. He'd actually been fooled, but he was still an arahat. So they let him back, you know. But the abbot was absolutely terrified of him dying in the monastery, because there were some people who believed that he was a fully liberated being. And now, if a fully liberated being dies in your monastery, it becomes a pilgrimage site. It would have been awful. Everybody wants to come and see where he lived. Oh, my goodness. So, anyway, when I went there about 4 years, he was still going. So. But he's still, you know, he's still convinced that he had actually been fully liberated. So beware. Beware. Very good. We'll bring it to an end, yeah? Just say thank you to all the people who help. Anthea, who's always here when I'm in. And Louisa, and Steve. And there's a lot more too, isn't there?
Yeah.
Don't even know, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Especially, you know, and... remember that these are quite difficult to organise, you know. There's a lot of responsibility involved. So I feel very grateful to them, really. An opportunity to, you know, share the Dharma.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much on behalf of everybody for sharing what you have and all your heartfelt knowledge. Thank you very much. I'm sure we've all had a really lovely day. As always.